Hello everybody out there, all you Paranormal Guide listeners. Today we have another Paranormal Profiles, and today we're talking with In the Dark Investigations. We have two of the teams. We have Chuck Gotsky, the team's founder, and Al Long, the team's case manager and one of the investigators. How you two doing over there?
We're doing great, man. How you doing?
Just fine.
I'm doing great. It's a bit of a brisk morning here for us. We're just starting to hit winter, so we've just come out of the nice Australian summer, and now we're going into a terrible, terrible winter, and I really do not like the cool weather.
I'm with you on that. We're over here. We're just starting to finally get out of the cooler weather and going to some warm weather finally.
Excellent. So we don't get so much snow over here, so do you guys get much snow out in Illinois?
Not so much anymore as we used to. Last few years have been pretty light, but get a lot of cold, a lot of severe cold.
A lot of slick on the roads. Well, hopefully you guys have a safe winter, but we're here to talk all about the paranormal today. Or tonight, over in America. I love the time difference.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, so I guess the very first place to start is, we'll go with Chuck to begin with, the team's founder. I guess, what first got you interested in the paranormal, and how did you go about founding your team?
Well, I got into it actually when I was, you know, a young child, but I guess it really caught home with me when I was a teenager, about 15 years old. My mom was at 36, had passed away from lung cancer. So after a period of time, of course, my dad went out and started doing, you know, the dating and stuff. So I had been home alone, sitting in the living room, you know, watching TV and stuff. And I, to explain it, make it a little easier, when she was at home before she passed away, at night, my dad would try to, like, you know, feed her food and stuff in the kitchen because, you know, it was really painful for her. And she would get up and pace around a lot and move things around and, you know, just be in a lot of pain. So now we move forward. I'm at home by myself. And I start hearing the walking and the pacing, which I myself had heard plenty of times. And I hear rumbling in the kitchen, and I go into the kitchen to find that, of course, there's nobody there. I'm by myself. And the other factor into that was that at the time she was alive, we had tiled floor in our kitchen, so you could hear like the footsteps and stuff like that. But I had forgotten when I went in there, we had carpeted the kitchen, so there was no tile floor. But I was still hearing the auditory of footsteps on the tile floor and like things being moved around the kitchen, though I was totally by myself. So after that, I just kind of found that, you know, intriguing. And wanted to know more about it and to find out, you know, if we go on after we pass away. So then, of course, as I got older, I just started getting into, you know, doing it myself, of course, on my own at first and with other people. And then we move forward to now where in 2010, I hooked up with the co-founder, Larry, who's not here. But I had hooked up with him because we had found out, you know, we had the same interests and I had some equipment. So I said, hey, you know, let's start doing some investigations, and it slowly built from there. And then I asked my buddy Al if he would like to join aboard, and he did. And then just recently we adopted a lady by the name of Janine. She's our researcher now and training investigator. And so since then, for the last like 3 years, we've been just doing it and going crazy and having a good time and learning an awful lot.
I like the way you use the term adopt. Like there's a lost investigator out in the wilderness somewhere, and you're like, yep, you can come with us. We could use another investigator in the team.
Let's get to the fold, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah, well, sorry to hear about your mother, but that did get you involved in the paranormal, and I can completely relate to that, because my father only died a couple of years ago of lung cancer himself. Unfortunately, he didn't give me any experiences. Maybe he knows I'm a bit girly when it comes to, you know, spooks and stuff. Maybe not wanting to freak me out. But I always find it interesting that a haunting, you know, like you said, you go out into the kitchen and it's the floorboard's been walked on, but now it had been carpeted. And sorry if I'm asking this question, if it's a bit personal, but at the time your mother was sick, was the floor carpeted?
When she was sick, it wasn't. It was actually a tiled floor.
Oh, okay,
because I'm kind of a worrywart when I was a kid, and I was very close to my mom, and so at nighttime I'm supposed to be sleeping, but I can hear all this happening, and that's how I kind of knew what the sounds were like enough, and it had happened so many times that I could kind of put it in context when it actually happened.
I guess a lot of people that are in this community, in this field, did start with a personal experience. It's not like you see a lot of people that just thought, I'm just going to, I watched this show on TV, I'm going to give it a crack. So really, yours had a much more pure beginning to it.
Correct. Yes, that's true. I mean, you know, I watch the shows like anybody else. I find them entertaining. I, you know, you can't really take a lot of what you see as gospel or anything. But no, for me, it was more of a, on a personal nature, and then just kind of learning and going through the journey. And then, you know, plus it's nice too, the camaraderie of having your friends with you and being able to get out and do something and all have the same kind of interest and all have the same kind of answers you want. You know, some answers given to you about what's happening and stuff like that. So,
besides that, it gives us a boys' night out.
Yeah, you know that too.
Yeah, then we'll have to hit Al with the same question. How did your passion with the paranormal begin? And basically, give us your story up until where you met Chuck and joined in the Dark Investigations.
Okay, when I was a youngster, we lived in a very, very old farmhouse. Actually had dirt floors in some parts of it. And I saw things and heard things that weren't right. I had nightmares just about every night. And that kind of, you know, I was scared. I wasn't interested in the paranormal at that time, but I surely remember all of that. And then after Vietnam, when I came home, lots of things started happening. In one case, I was working one night at a really old boiler factory. I was working security late shift just by myself. And as I was sitting at a desk reading a book, I had a finger poke me in the back three different times, and each time it was hard enough to actually move me forward. And there was no one in the building at all but myself. And I'll tell you, at that time, I spent the rest of the night guarding from outside in my car. But that's just one thing. And then the reason that I got into this with Chuck, we've done some other things together, and we're best friends. As you get older, as I'm sure you're all young people there, but myself, I'm going to be 62. I've had some life and death experiences, and I've been given the last rites a couple of different times. I've had open heart surgery. And as you get older, you realize your own mortality, and you look hard to find answers before you pass.
You both had personal experiences with life and death. You, Al, from what I gather, have you died? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I did twice when they were working on my heart. They brought me back both times. And then when they did the heart surgery, it was about 11 and a half hours. And, of course, to do a four-way, that's your four arteries, they take your heart out, and it sits in a bucket of ice while they work on all the arteries and everything, trying to repair them. So, I died twice. The first time I was in a house explosion, I got burnt very bad. That was in, 77, I believe, 77 or 78. And I got burnt pretty bad. It burnt my face, and it was a third degree, most all from my upper body. And they gave me the last rites there twice, but I made it through that one. So I'm not Catholic, but I was in a Catholic hospital, and they told me that the priest had been in a couple of times when I was fading.
Far out. That you have been, house explosions and quadruple bypasses and as well as being in a war as well. That so you've had some incredible situations where you're no doubt close to death. They do say that if you have been close to death, and this as well goes with Chuck just as well, because you had a parent die when you were quite young, it says it can make you more open to the paranormal. Do you believe, looking back on your experiences, that's true?
Yeah, actually, I do feel that that's true. Just like when we go on investigations, and, you know, because investigations are not just the tools that you use and all the flashy gadgets, which are nice to collect your data, but the most important thing is your personal experiences and how you feel when you go into a particular area and what you pick up on. And I think that knowing, you know, having that knowledge does help and kind of fuels the way you go about your investigations and what you wind up experiencing and collecting.
How do you answer that question now?
About the same, yeah. You have to have an intuition for these things, and you get more sensitive to it as time goes on. And certainly the more experiences you've had with death, with family or friends or close calls yourself, yeah, it makes you more in touch.
I sent Chuck a whole bunch of questions before this interview, and you describe your team's style as being tech-based while using an observation and participation style. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? That seems to go with what you just said. You have your intuition, but I guess you use technology to back up your findings?
Yeah, that's correct. Basically, you know, because if you look in, you know, if you're talking, you know, like a lot of people will say, well, we're scientific based. Okay, that's kind of a twofold kind of answer, because unless we're doing experimentation in a controlled environment, we aren't 100% scientific, because that's, you know, that's experimentation. That's how the purest of scientific is experimentation. So I go about it as we go to locations, we sit, we observe, we try to participate by meaning, you know, experimenting with different theories and ideas, from, you know, trigger objects to music to whatever, to try to get a response so that we can then collect data such as, you know, your millimeters, your K2 meters, your, you know, any kind of your SB7s for audio, to try to gather that data and kind of place it into a way that you can say, oh, you know what, when we do this, we actually get responses quite often. So how is that in context to what we're doing? Plus, you know, what's the everything from environment? You know, what's the environment at that time? What's the atmosphere at that time? What, you know, try to gather all that to see if you can come up with some kind of a plot of how things are working. And is there like a certain key to all of this? Or is it just right place at the right time kind of thing? You know what I mean?
One of the things we do, mainly with our private cases, we don't do a lot of them, but what we do take some on is we leave a diary with the client to record when things are happening, what the weather was like, so we can try to establish a pattern before we go there. Is that a part of how you guys investigate?
Well, the same goes for us. We don't do a lot of residents, but the few we haven't done the diary idea, which I kind of like. Maybe I'll try that.
Yep.
But we do go into the, after we're done with the investigation, going to them and saying, hey, have you had any experiences or anything? You know, like, try not to get too much information up front, just enough so you know how to do your investigation, but then go more in depth with them later to see what they have as far as information that then might then fit. I kind of like calling them like a puzzle, fit that puzzle to even broaden the scope of what you found.
You did say you would love to go to a location where you could have scientific controls in the situation, in the paranormal, I guess, in the haunted location. Well, how do you envisage that be? What would be the ideal setting for you to investigate, for you to properly carry out a scientific experiment?
Well, you know, like take any kind of a building that's really, really haunted, of course, you know, try to find ones that at least are purported to have the claims of events, you know, because it's, that's important also. And, you know, like, you know, I know a lot of these shows, they do the lockdowns and kind of stuff like that, but I mean, it's kind of the same thing. It's sealing off the building, having the correct equipment, having the correct people that, you know, they're knowledgeable in all different aspects, such as I've always thought of a lot of times, like we all go out, we do investigations with all our, like I said before, millimeters, all that kind of stuff. But how about going with equipment that could monitor the human aspect, your brain waves, your body temperature, your heartbeat, all that kind of stuff, to kind of see if how we are connected to what's happening. And by having like the building, you know, sealed off and having just a certain amount of people there and knowing that there is no environmental contamination and no one else within a certain realm of the building, whatever you're then gathering is in its purest form. And then by using the human element, by trying to gauge that also, maybe put the two together and get a better answer of what's happening.
As a case manager, Al, how much of that coming about and that situation, I guess, or being able to control the location falls to you. Is that part of your job? Are you also a location manager?
Sometimes. The main thing I do is, we find locations on the internet. I find locations by talking to people in their towns. What have they experienced? Are there any haunted areas in their town? And I've picked up quite a bit of stuff that way. And get all the details that I can, go out to the sites, look at them, talk to whoever's in charge or owner of the sites. If they're interested in letting us do it, then I get answers from them about the what has gone on there in the past and everything that interesting that's ever happened. And then we set up a time and we go from there.
Sweet. Sounds like your team is quite well organized.
we get that from people that have watched us or had us in. They like the way we do things. And we go in to an investigation not just to say, oh, I heard a noise, there's a ghost. Oh, you know, there's another sound, that's a ghost. We don't do that. We go in, and whatever we've heard about, whatever they've seen or whatever they've heard, we try and find explanations for those sights or noises. And we go through all of that, and anything that we can't explain away, we say is basically paranormal, or it's up to the individual to decide, you know, how they feel about it or what they think.
I think the debunking process, which I guess is what you're talking about, is very important on investigations. And there are, I guess the shows are made for entertainment, so I guess they let a lot of things slide just for that entertainment value.
Yeah, a lot of things,
but
yeah.
Do you have any specific situations where you've gone into a location, there was a certain type of activity happening that you were able to say, well, it was just this leaky water pipe hitting this drum in the corner or something? Do you have any specific situations that you can talk us through there?
We've had, there's been a few. I'm just trying to think of, you know, ones that you could explain away. Like, we did one residence where they kept saying, we're thinking we're seeing this dog running up and down the lawn and right in front of the house, back and forth, and we think it's a haunting and it's an invisible dog and all this kind of stuff. And then when we went to investigate, we found that from the front of the home, where their electrical box is, there's a line that also runs across the lawn in the same visual way that they're seeing the apparition or whatever, running to another power pole that sits out in front of their house, which is causing what, you know, I guess some people call a fear cage or whatever you want to call it, but basically a huge, I mean, off the scales, high amount of EMF. I'm sure you know as well as anybody that, you know, high EMF can cause hallucinatory, hallucinatory ways of seeing things or thinking they're seeing things or sensing things or putting things in their head that maybe they're seeing something that they're not really seeing. Hmm. And by breaking that all down, we were able to find, because they never even knew that that was all right there, it basically explained kind of like they were feeling creepy, and why are we feeling creepy all the time? Why are we standing right here? And why are we thinking we're seeing this and stuff like that? And basically after that was found, the experience didn't happen anymore.
We have done a couple of cases, especially in pubs, where the staff will say they have an eerie feeling going down a certain corridor, and it turns out that on the other side of the wall from that corridor is one of their call rooms. And I'm not sure if you've done any pubs, but their compressors and then the motors on these fridges put out an amazing amount of EMF. And you can, if you stand in those situations for a minute or two, you can start to feel it. So how does a client take that? Because a client doesn't always understand what EMF is or what it does. It's almost like it's some mystical energy to them at times. How do you go about explaining that to them, that this is very likely what you're experiencing?
Well, you can't discount how they feel or what their thoughts were, because they came over to my house so I could actually go over all the stuff we had found from it. And I didn't want to discount their feelings and just say, oh, you know, you're crazy people, and, you know, this is what it is, you know what I mean? Because that doesn't really go over too well when you tell someone they're crazy. So I wound up just saying, you know, I understand your thought process and what you think you're seeing. Let me give you an alternative to what it might be, what I feel it might be, from doing what we do and been doing it long enough to understand it, this is how I think it might be affecting you. And I said, and if you want, you can look up on the internet. You can look up EMF. There's plenty of information on the net about it to be able to explain to you that, and it's proven in fact, in scientific experiments in controlled environments, that high amounts of EMF can make you hallucinate, can make you think or feel that you're seeing something. It can also make you feel extremely creepy, nauseous, dizzy, all that kind of stuff. They actually thought that was kind of interesting and, you know, of course, had not thought of that themselves because they didn't know that, but they took away from it that maybe that might possibly be what it was, and I didn't really, you know, without me telling them that, you know, whatever they thought and felt was totally wrong, I just felt that, you know, this is probably what it is. They took away a very healthy new attitude and got some knowledge about it and was fine.
So you were educating at the same time as going in and investigating, which I think is very important that the public understands that you're not there. You can't just go in and say, this is a ghost or this isn't a ghost. All you can really do is give them data and let them really make up their own mind, see if that kind of helps explain what they're experiencing.
You know, a lot of people, they call it evidence. I guess we can call it evidence. We also call it just events. There are events that are happening.
Yep.
But, you know, when you show something like an event that happened, whether it's K2 session, whether it's audio, whatever, you have to let them know that, you know, it's all based on what they feel or think they might be hearing, because, you know, everybody's going to take away something different from, you know, one thing could be totally different to 10 different people. So you can say, this is what we feel it is, and then now you need to step forward and see, do you feel the same or do you feel it's different? Because really, if they're still experiencing something out of it, whether it's the same as what I think or the same as what someone else thinks, at least they can see that it's, you know, once you can show it's not in the norm, it's at least it's paranormal, which just means out of the norm, you know what I mean?
When you're measuring for EMF, what is your preferred device? I want to start talking a little bit about the equipment that you guys use. You've mentioned the K2, but do you have any of the other detectors? Do you have any mel meters or anything like that in your equipment?
Yeah, we actually use mel meters for our main devices as far as you know, looking for EMF. Just like we do our baselines and stuff like that, we go into each individual room. We do what we call high to low. You do 4 points of the room. You do high, and you do the highest amount of EMF. The highest on temperature or lowest on temperature, depending on what you're doing. Then you do the 4 points on the lowest part of the room and the same thing, and you record those. So you have a kind of a baseline of that room as far as your EMF gauging and your temperature gauging, and of course making sure whatever's in the room you mark down if there's like a alarm clock and kind of stuff like that. So you have kind of a base to follow with. But yeah, we use a millimeter for the most part as far as trying to gauge EMF, along of course with a K2. And I also like to use a compass, which is old school, when you're using a K2 to see if, because, you know, these things are very sensitive, does it affect like the magnetic field, does it affect the compass the way it affects the electric devices? So, but yeah, millimeter is the main thing that we use for EMF.
Have you been in a situation where a compass has reacted to a situation that you're in?
I have not as of yet. I have tested it where I've had the K2 going like crazy, but yet the compass is not. So, no, I have not as of yet found that to work, which I find kind of interesting considering that they say they're supposed to gauge electromagnetic fields, you know, because once you have an electronic field, the outside of it is magnetic. Mm-hmm. And so how is it not affecting this, you know, why I'm seeing the gauging on the electrical devices, but I'm not seeing it on a manual device, I guess. But yeah, no, I haven't had anything yet happen with it. Yeah, but I like to use like old school with, you know, with the new devices too, because I think old school still has its place. Like we use a bell, you know, because I know you got a lot of these iPods and everything's ringing off all the time, you know, but you got to remember too, you get a lot of false positives with environmental factors. So you have to keep that in mind when you're using these things. You can't just jump up and down like a little schoolgirl and get all excited every time something goes off. You gotta take a step back and see what's really going on. So I like to use like a bell. So that way, if I can get the bell to be rung, then, I know that there's more of a force or control to it than just, you know, fluctuations in the environment.
Al, what's a piece of equipment that you find yourself using quite often?
Well, I use the EMF meters quite a bit, the mel meters, I use them. But Myself, I use a digital camera and take pictures of various areas, and we usually take them three at a time, you know, three shots of the same thing, so you can see if anything changes in those three shots. And I have a night vision handy cam with the infrared lighting. We use things like that. And the K2 meters. I mean, I love the K2 meters. We've gotten some really, really good results using the K2s.
Yeah, especially in the documentary that we shot.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and our documentary is the best we've ever gotten so far.
Our investigation protocol is basically go in, one team does baseline readings, where the other team pulls all the equipment and gets them set into different, you know, sets for us. We also use logbooks to log our ins and outs of every area we go into. So when we step into an area, you actually just do a physical write down. This is the time I'm in. This is the area I'm in. This is the time I leave. So that way, which has become very beneficial in knowing where everyone's at all the time, because you can use, you know, your digital recorders when you're doing your EVP. We also like to set like digital recorders that run constant all the time. Even though we have our mobile ones, we run ones in certain areas. They just run the whole night long.
Yep.
So, you know, you can kind of find out time-wise from video to audio where you're at, but I feel the logbooks are going to be a big help on knowing exactly when I'm going through evidence, because I do most of the evidence stuff myself at the end, where everyone's at and located, so when I'm checking these things, I know what's what.
Evidence review must take ages with all the data you guys are collecting.
Yeah, you could say that. Centuries. like right now, you know, it's like we went to Willow Creek and we did, you know, you figure we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I have 5 recorders. 3 of them actually ran for the 4 or 5 hours we were there. Then you got the mobile ones that are on and off most of the time. Now you throw in 1, 2, 3, 4 cameras, 3 IRs, 1 full spectrum, they're running most of the time. If you're using DVR, like our DVR system, which we use also on certain occasions, that's another 4 cameras at, you know, 4 hours each. So, yeah, it adds up to quite a lot of time to sift through everything and, you know, pull out the small bits that you get, because it's really just the small bits. You get, like, all that. That's really all it adds up to, you know, at the end of the day. But, yeah, it takes quite a lot of time and patience. And I log everything as I'm writing it down, and then I have to go back and cut and trim and, you know, just to take the sections out that you want to hear. And so, yeah, it takes a lot. We just did Willow Creek, and we have coming in May, we're doing the first Ward House, which is in Wisconsin Rapids. And then we also have in June, we're going to Alton, Illinois to do the Mineral Springs Hotel, which is actually now an antique mall.
Those two. Alton, Illinois is the most haunted city in Illinois.
Yeah. So, and both of those are going to be overnighters. So this isn't like a 4 or 5 hour thing that's going to be like overnight. So yeah, they're going to kind of, they're going to kind of overlap a little there, Ash. So.
Now, a lot of the people that have been on the Paranormal Guide Facebook page will see that nearly daily I put up a new post about something strange, bizarre, dark, the paranormal. And a lot of the posts that I've done on haunted locations or urban legends have been in Illinois, especially around the Chicago area. I know you have some larger cases that you've been on, but a lot of our listeners will have seen my post on Bachelor's Grove Cemetery, and I know you guys have been out there, so can you tell us a little bit about what took you out there and any findings you may have had?
Sure. I'll go ahead and talk about that, because that was before Al was with us, but
yep.
Larry and I actually went there. We took a group of some of the people that we actually worked with out there. Of course, we went during the day, because if you go at nighttime, then you wind up in, you know, jail. And it's just no fun being in jail, Ash. I don't know why, but, you know. So we have to go during the day. So we did go in there. I mean, actually just going into Bachelor's Grove is probably just as creepy, or not creepier, than in Bachelor's Grove, because you got to walk down this really long wooded trail. And the urban legends of, like, people, satanic worshiping people hiding in the trees and jumping on you and all this stuff. So, you know, you get all these legends rolling around in your brain, and then you look at this trail and it's actually something right out of the horror movie. So it's kind of creepy.
Yeah. I just want to mention something there. I've seen photos of this trail, and just for our listeners at home, if you have seen the movie Evil Dead, it is just like the dirt road there. Yeah. Trees outside, creepy, absolutely freaky.
Yes, it is. It's really weird. So, like, and we went, like, when it was still cool out, so it's not, like, all beautifully green and, you know, like it does in the summer. We're kind of, like, at the end of the winter, and, yeah, it's really creepy. So you go back in there, and then the actual cemetery is not that large. It's actually pretty small. It's just a small squared-in area with a fence, which half the fence is knocked down anyway, so you could get in regardless. Unfortunately, The place, of course, is just not kept or anything like that. I mean, the stones are knocked over, some are cracked, and it's actually kind of sad. I mean, knowing that these people are buried there, and you know, this is how it just fell into disarray like that. But we did go back in there. We did some EV, you know, some audio and video. We did get like one weird piece of audio. Other than that, not too much. We did find a huge giant like fire pit where I don't know if they sit around nighttime dancing around the fire and, you know, sacrificing chickens or whatever, you know. But just, you know, that's just kind of creepy in itself. We did find something really weird though in there, not paranormal, but we were actually there's a tree in the center of the cemetery, and we were like, what's up in the tree there? Because it looked like, you know, like a paper, a piece of paper or a newspaper or something like it was white. And so we had one of the guys climb up in there, and he brings it down, and it's an actual skull of like a deer or something. Totally, you know, just the skull itself, like white, bleach white clean, just propped up way up in the tree. We found that to be slightly disturbing, you know, to all of us. We couldn't figure out why it was up there, so that was kind of weird. We did take some photographs, which I did get one weird anomaly. It looks like actually like a dog standing in the woods, but of course when we were there, there was nobody there. We pretty much had enough people where we covered the area pretty good. So, but as far as anything else, we didn't get it. It's just, you know, it is a very creepy place. There is the one stone to of the unknown child, which is kind of sad because there's like toys everywhere that people have left for, I don't know if it's a him or her, to be honest with you, but, and we did see the stone where they had that famous picture, you know, where the lady's sitting on the stone.
Yeah, the chessboard looking stone, was it?
Yeah, exactly. Now, we didn't see like there's also the, I don't know if you know all the stories, but there's the story of the disappearing farmhouse that's supposed to appear and disappear. We saw nothing like that. Also, that trail actually used to be a road because it used to be like a one-lane, I don't know if it was a highway or a road, that cars used to travel through there a long time ago, and they say sometimes you can see like a phantom car going there, but we didn't see anything like that either. So, but we stayed, you know, a considerable amount of time and walked away from saying, hey, at least, you know, we were there and stuff like that. But I would say that if you were there at nighttime, that place would be extremely creepy. Oh, I mean, it's creepy. Yeah, it's really dark back there. So
just walking up that path at night would be creepy enough. And then the gates, which are the gates still there, or are they gone? There was meant to be some big gates.
Well, yeah, there's a gate, but it was, I mean, when we went there, the gate was open, you know, because you walk up and there's like a garbage can that says Bachelor's Grove. And I'm like, well, that's not too creepy, you know. And then you got the gate, which is already open. And then a lot of the fencing, because it's chain link, you can see where it's like curved up or like just broken through. So you could, even if the gate was up, you could just climb through, you know, parts of the gate. Though the gates are creepy in the fact that all the trees and stuff like that, the vines have like intertwined with like the chain link fencing. So it's kind of like, it's like Evil Dead right there, you know, with the trees and stuff. It's like just totally weird looking. So in that respect, yeah, it was pretty freaky.
And you mentioned you found a deer skull high up in a tree, and I understand that you've had another experience with a deer at another cemetery.
Yeah, that was actually when Al and I went to go actually do location scouting for going to the cemetery to do an investigation. I'll tell you about how that transpired.
We just call it Kendall County Cemetery because they don't really want us to use the name.
Yep.
We got back in there, and it was starting to get dark, and like Chuck says, we were scouting it. We were going to be there the following week. And we were walking around through, there were lots of big trees, lots of big oak trees. We thought we heard something, and we didn't see anything, and then something just popped, a white face just popped out at us, and it was a deer, just came out of nowhere. It kind of catches you, takes you aback. You don't expect to find a deer in the cemetery, but he come popping out, and we were little girls about it.
Yeah. Oh, you know, once we changed the underwear, we were okay.
Oh, I've had a similar experience here in Australia. You've no doubt heard of kangaroos. Now, if you're out in the bush or the scrub somewhere and you're in an old cemetery, just because there's a fence around it doesn't mean these animals can't get in. So they can jump pretty high. And if you're walking through the dark and all you've got is a pretty dodgy old torch and it's all misty, and then you hear thump, thump, thump coming towards it, and you just see this black blurred, like, jump past your eye height, that makes you jump as well. So I can completely sympathize with your deer experience there.
Yeah, that was pretty weird, you know, because I think I had seen it first before Al did, and I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, wow, that's a really large statue of a deer. Who would put a giant statue of a deer over there? I'm like, well, maybe it's a hunter and he loved deers. I don't know, you know. So yeah, that's pretty weird.
Deers, wildlife, I reckon the most scares investigators do get when they're out on investigation will be just random wildlife that happens to be in the location. If you're not expecting it and all of a sudden there's life, well, that can definitely make you jump.
Yeah, that's true, because when we go to Willow Creek, you know, you got to sign a waiver, you know, because Willow Creek farm, you're out in the middle of nowhere. You're pretty much out in the middle of nowhere. And so he has a waiver, and I'm like, well, why are we signing this waiver? And it's not because you're going to break anything in the home or anything like that. It's in case you get eaten by coyotes or any other wildlife, that it's not his responsibility.
Willow Creek. I reckon we can talk about that right now. You've talked a little bit about it. It's kind of leading up. I know there's a DVD that you've made set there. I want to know all about Willow Creek. I want to know a little bit about the history. Don't give away everything that's in the DVD, of course. I like a surprise for when I grab a copy. But what took you out there? What's a bit of the history? What kind of activity takes place there? And maybe a little bit of the stuff that you found.
How did we actually find that? Was it you that found that out? Or?
Well, you mentioned it to me, and I contacted the owner. I had a phone number and contacted the owner, Al Kitchener, who's the owner of Willow Creek Farm, and asked him about the possibility of us doing an investigation. And Al was real gracious, really happy to have us. And when a lot of these places now that have been famous or that people have gone into at investigations, they want you to pay to go in. And in some cases, it's big money. So my first question to Al was, what do you charge? And his answer was, this is my home, and the spirits are my family, and I invite you into my home. Why would I charge money for that? This is not a hotel. And we went from there.
You know, once we found that out and we were all excited, you know, because we knew how the legends or the claims from, I mean, they have constant, I mean, like I just talked to him today, and he has, like, he's booked every weekend through November already, because they have every kind of different style of team from, you know, they even do, I guess they do seances out there with some people, just an array of different kinds of styles of people that go out there and do it. And then, you know, there's a lot of background to it from, like, I guess earliest to the land, like the 1600s and stuff, you know, when it was a one building town / you know, area, to what it is now with all the different history and stuff like that. And they had the Black Hawk Wars out there. They've had quite a lot of different things in history that have happened out there also. And then I guess in 2006, I believe, is when he took over as the owner, because he'd come from New York, and he says, you know what, I want to have a farmhouse. And so he moved out there. He saw it. He fell in love with it right away. He just felt that it was meant to be. And so, yeah, we took ourselves out there, and because we wanted to see if what everybody was saying was true. They were correct on quite a lot. We went out there. We had an array of experiences that you can think of. Because, I mean, there's every claim in the world out there, from being touched to, you know, seeing apparitions, the mists, to audio.
Al was actually on my ghost story.
Yeah.
And caught him on there. He had a medium and a couple of people going through there, and we caught that also. Just before we went.
Right. So, so we went and we investigated the claims and found it to be more than what we actually thought. And I'm not meaning, you know, like, you know, like a movie like Poltergeist, where things are flying around and whacking you in the head, and you know that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's very subtle, but little bits of everything happened while we were there. And then when you start taking it all in context and adding it all up, from personal experiences to readings to audio to being touched to, you know, all this different stuff, by the end of the night we were just like blown away that there was that much actually transpiring. So we said, you know, and when we went out there we were like, you know what, we're going to take something with us because we want to document this in case we can, you know, put something together to show people what it's really about. And it worked out really great because when we were there, quite a lot happened, like I said, and we got a lot of it on film, and went ahead and just, you know, took it from there. So, and we went out there just a couple days ago again. We go out there, like, it's going to be like a yearly thing. He's become kind of like a friend or a family member to us. So
yeah, we were just out there Saturday, the 20th.
Yeah, so we, you know, we make it a once-a-year stop. Maybe we might go out again just to hang out with the guy, too, because he's a really nice guy.
It's really good when you can develop a rapport with the owner of a location and you can go back there repeatedly, because to me, an investigation is generally not just a one-off event. It's something that you want to go back to again and again under different circumstances. So it sounds like you've really got, I guess, a signature location for yourselves there.
That's yeah. Exactly true.
Yeah. In fact, in November, they had some mental / physical attacks on some of the people, and maybe I guess some of the negative entities that were there. So they went ahead and did a cleansing, I guess, of the area. So when we went back there this time, it was a lot more calmer. A lot of the things were a little bit different, but I mean, we still had some, you know, experiences and events that were happening, which I'm just going through now, so I don't have a lot of it yet, but there were some things that actually happened, like a door opening and things of that nature. So it has changed, but still is active. So it was kind of interesting to see the dichotomy of the two different, you know, before and after, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, it's just different activities.
And that's the importance of going back to a location as many times as you really can. So what's the actual layout of the farm like? Is it still a working farm, or is it just an old farm homestead that this gentleman happens to be living in?
It is an old farmstead that this gentleman's living in, exactly. He has quite large two-story farmhouse, a big machine shop where he has about 8 or 9 antique John Deere tractors in there, and an old barn that he's going to start restoring this year, he said. It's getting in a pretty run-down condition. And things had happened in there. A guy was killed in the old days, way back when. One of the homesteaders there was killed by a horse, kicked him in the head. I guess he was probably trying to shoe it or whatever. And a few little things like that have happened. There is farmland being farmed around him. He doesn't have anything to do with that. He just basically has the house and barns. And then the fields are probably leased to a local farmer.
That's interesting. So that, although it isn't a farm anymore, there's still some of that farming energy going on around the place, which I guess would be familiar with the spirits that are on location.
Right, exactly.
And he says he believes it's his family. Have you guys captured any evidence that helps support that?
One of the things that I guess when he first got the farm, they had found a quilt that was sewn by a lady by the name of Sarah, who was seen quite often in the home. I mean, there's at least 9 entities from, you know, like Lily, Mary, Joe. We have a new guy, Paul. So there's a lot of different entities that kind of come and go. Like, it's not only just people who have actually lived on the land. They believe, and this is what's stated, is that there's a vortex or a doorway to the other side in this area where entities can come and go. But we did, one of the interesting things that occurred was when we went in on the documentary, you can hear it and see it, or actually hear it. There's a gentleman by the name of Big Mike, I guess he used to be a farmer out in that area, who now resides as an entity at the farm. We were doing an EVP session, and we had caught an actual EVP of him saying Michael, his name Michael. Now, at the time, we just knew him as Big Mike, so I didn't know anything about the terminology of how to use his name correctly. But then when I sent it to Al at the farm, he came back and said he was very excited about that and moved by that, because the fact is that when he speaks to him as Michael, not Mike. And here was Michael coming back to him saying, you know, like answering to him, Michael, is that you? And then you hear Michael. So it was kind of cool that it kind of like all fit together like that. And it was like recognition that, you know, he was there and that he does know Al's there, and that they do have this, you know, going back and forth of conversation and feelings for each other.
So you've had quite a large range of experiences there. You've had interaction with devices such as the K2. You've captured EVPs. You've had physical stuff happening such as doors opening and close. Have you guys seen anything at this location?
As far as visuals, nothing direct in line in front of your face, like apparitions or anything like that. Sometimes it's like really fleeting, like you'll catch shadows out of the corner of your eye, or and know that you've seen something move, but nothing in direct or catch on film of like shadows or shadow people or like photographs of a person standing or anything like that. We haven't caught that part of it yet, though. Last time I was there, I did get touched on the back, which I found to be very interesting because it was during the day. We had just gotten there. We had just unloaded. We weren't even starting yet. And I had whoever's fingers actually physically touch my back, just like, you know, a person would be if they're pressing down. And because it was a cold day, we had, you know, dressed up pretty warm. So I had like a shirt, a vest. We wear vests. We had a shirt, a vest, and I had like a sweatshirt underneath. And I could feel the pressure through all three of those enough to make me turn around quickly and look at the guy who's shooting the documentary, which is about 4 feet behind me. And I'm like, did you touch me? And he's like, no, I'm way back here. And I'm like, I could just feel it was very exciting to feel actual fingers on your back, which, you know, or felt like human fingers on your back. And yet there was nobody there.
Isn't that just the way when you're not fully set up yet, the equipment's not running, and that's when activity decides to take place? Do you guys find that happens quite often?
Yeah, that always happens. That's just part of the. That's how you have to chalk it up to personal experiences, and that's why sometimes it's funny when skeptics go, "Well, you can't prove that." It's like, no, but I experienced it. So unless I'm lying to you, you know, I mean, it actually happened, you know.
Yeah, and then Saturday we took a guy from Paranormal Underground Radio, Rick, with us, who has done investigations and still does on his own, and we heard a little hallway down to the old basement in this place, and it's got the old style metal lift latch on it. And we heard that latch open up. There was nobody down there or around. We were all in this sitting room, and we heard that, and Rick got up to look down the hallway and actually felt something pass through him. He was pretty excited about that.
Yeah, kind of took him off guard a little bit on that, on that one.
He wasn't expecting that.
No, plus earlier in the investigation, when we first got there, he was shining his laser light in that same area, same doorway, and he saw like a head just bend over and peek out and look at him. So he kind of got excited. So we walked back into that area and took a gauge temperature into that area, and we were actually said, can you go down to, it was like a 61 degrees. Can you down to 59 degrees and then stop there, and you could watch it actually go down all the way to 59 degrees and hold. And we go, okay, can you take it to 58? And it did it, and it held. Then we went to 57, and it held. So it actually was working with us, going exactly where we wanted it to go, which was just amazing. Of course, there's no cameras running or nothing, so it's just basically me and Rick, you know what I mean? But, yeah, it was still cool all the same.
Yeah, and he didn't just shine a laser light. He had a laser grid light that sets up the grid so that you can actually see anything moving in front of it. And that's when he saw the head bending down.
See, I don't think there's anything wrong with the personal experience. They're important for the investigator. But I also find I do like to see the evidence. I do like to listen to an EVP or look at a nice photograph. But really, personal experiences have a lot more to them. It's like the spirits kind of know, you know, well, you're not filming, so I can give you a little. I can give you a little bit more. And I always wonder why, if that is the case, why don't they want to give us evidence?
Chuck had an interesting thing with that. The first time we were there, when we were out in the barn, we had a K2 meter, and we had a spirit box, and he was asking questions, you know, can you light us up? Can you answer me or whatever like that? And we're all looking at this thing, and nothing's happening. Chuck would look away to do something else, and it would flash. And It did that several times. Every time he'd look away, the thing would play.
Every stinking time I turned away, I was doing it, and I could hear them all laughing, and then I turn around, I was stopping, and I go, okay, fine, and I turn the other way, do it again. Sure enough, as soon as I turn the other way, you see it like twice on the documentary, so yeah, it was pretty funny.
The spirit realm needs entertainment too.
Yes, we are definitely entertainment for them, that's for sure.
Is the DVD, the documentary, shot over just the one of your outings out there, or is it a bit of a meshing of several trips?
No, it's actually just the first time we actually ever went out there, from beginning to end. It's not a meshing of a bunch of different, like this time or whatever. It's just the one time deal, and just everything that we basically went through while we were there.
And that was September 2012.
And what gave you the idea to film a documentary on your first visitation out to Willow Creek Farm?
My thoughts behind it were, you know, I watch a lot of the shows, and I like the shows, don't get me wrong, and I think they're entertaining. But I wanted to put something out there that people could see that's more on the wavelength of what we as paranormal investigators really do, less the drama, less the crazy, dude, did you hear that? And, you know, spinning around and watching them set up for an hour and a half. And I tried to cut everything down to basically, we're here, we unload, we set up, here we go, here's all the evidence. And then we just kind of put it in together in kind of a form as it slowly wields itself to the ending. And that's it, you know, and kind of give them a taste of what, you know, really it's really all about. Less, of course, the hours and hours of just staring in the dark and nothing happening, you know. I don't want to do that because then you'd just be sleeping and you wouldn't watch the documentary, so, you know.
Yeah, just a six-hour multi-screen video of just nothing. But that is the reality of investigating. But yeah, you still got to keep people engaged in what you're filming, what you're presenting. So
Right, exactly. Yeah, you know, it's just like if you wanted to watch someone go fishing for like 10 hours out in a boat. You know what I mean? It's like after like the first half an hour and you're nodding off. You know what I mean? So
it's 42 minutes and it's a you know, an explanation of the place and ourselves, who we are and what we do. And what we found that night, and us saying goodbye to the spirits and leaving.
Excellent. So start to end the full package. And at 42 minutes, suspiciously, that sounds about the length that an hour-long TV show would go for with commercials. Have you guys thought about putting it out there at all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'd very much like to get it put out on as many stations as we can get. We'd love it.
Sure, wherever it wants to go, it's fine. We're not in it to make, you know, big bucks or become famous. That's not the point of it. It's nice to get our name out there just so people know that we're reputable and that we are really interested in the field. And it's always nice to meet people like you and, you know, other people that are in the field.
Yeah, we want to share.
Right, for that fact. But yeah, we're more than willing to say, you know, you want to put it on your website, there's a copy, put it on your website. You know, it doesn't really matter to us. It's just getting it out there so people can kind of see it and see that we have what love we have for the field and what we do.
Yeah, and it'll also be interesting seeing how another team works as well. And every team can take something away from seeing that.
Correct, exactly, yeah. You know, yeah, because, you know, every team does things different. That's the same way I am. I look online and I check other teams and I look at other websites and I see and I take things away and go, oh, you know, it'd be kind of cool. Maybe I should try incorporating that. Let's try that, you know. So I think that I'm pro para unity kind of guy, you know. I think that in order for us to understand what's going on, in order for us to get the answers that most of us are all in this for, I think we need to not worry about so much, hey, you look at me kind of a thing, and go more for the, hey, what can we do sharing wise to, from a, you know, a standpoint to each other to find those answers that we're all really striving to get.
Absolutely. It's that coming together and sharing what you have. The more data that is brought together, it gives us a better chance of really seeing those patterns in the type of activity that's taking place and really being able to narrow down on the best time to go out and investigate a location or investigate in general.
Yep, that's true. I totally believe that. You know, because there's a lot of teams out there that they don't want to share their stuff and they don't want to, you know, show you their stuff or how they do things because they're afraid you're going to take something from them. But, you know, that's, if you're in it for that, you shouldn't be in it. You know, that's just my opinion. my opinion is, if you're in it, you're in it because you love it, because you want to get answers for it. And so the only way to do that is by sharing and compiling and trying different methods in order to get to that point where you get those answers.
Something else you'll notice on our documentary, you get a chance to see it, you're not going to see us. You're not going to see our faces and waving and smiling at everybody. You're going to see what's actually going on. You won't see very much of us up close and personal. You'll just see what we do and what we find.
Yeah, well, we do have the cool beginning, though, with some music, and we all go in slow motion and look. So, we had to throw something in there, Ash,
You got to have that beginning, don't you? And
That was our chance to go, we'll just try like the other guys because it's so cool looking. So, yeah, we did that.
Yeah, you got the big jackets, the tattoos, and the hair gel going.
Oh, yeah. No. We do have hats with vests and logos, but I was talking to someone about that, and they're like, because somebody made a comment, all these guys, they invest in the vests, and I was like, this is the way I looked at it. I took it from the perspective of, I'm not doing it because I want to look cool. I'm doing it because, for instance, if I had a plumber come to my house and he's wearing ripped up jeans and a shirt on backwards with his hat cocked to the side versus a guy coming up that's in a professional looking uniform like a plumber with his name tag on there, I'm probably going to trust the other guy, unfortunately, because it's a book by its cover kind of a deal. I'm probably going to go for the other guy, probably a little bit better than the guy with the crazy jeans and the shirt and all
that. Yeah, we're looking for professionalism. People look at us. We're nice and neat. We don't have long hair. I got nothing against long hair, but when you're old, it doesn't grow anymore, so you don't have to worry about it.
I've just recently had to get the razor out of my hair myself.
So, yeah, we're just looking to look professional. Yeah, exactly. Right. Just professional. So, people take us serious because, there's a lot of people that see a lot of the silly stuff on TV and think, these guys are just...
It's such a ragged bum standing on their porch. They're not apt to open the door.
Yeah, they have to lock the door, call 911, and put down the shades,
Locking up all their valuables. So,
yeah, exactly.
If people want a copy of...
And their daughters.
And their daughters. Watch out, look up your daughters in the dark investigations are in your town. All right, so where can people get a copy of this DVD? I see it's available on your website. If you want to provide us with the URL, that would be fantastic.
You can go to www.inthedarkinvestigations.com. Right now we're just taking money order checks because doing PayPal and all that stuff, it's kind of, expensive because you got to do the business thing, and I can't really afford that right now. But if you send us a check or money order, as long as we let the check clear, we're good. We'll send it out to you. We'll get it to you, and I can guarantee that you will enjoy it.
Excellent. And do you have a presence on Facebook or Google Plus or any locations like that?
Well, yeah, I'm on Twitter. We're also on Facebook at Into Dark Investigations. You can find us there. I keep it updated all the time. Other than that, yeah, it's basically the website and the Facebook page.
Well, thank you very much, Chuck. And now it's been great talking to you today.
It's been great talking to you, Ash. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us small folk out here in the United States of America.
Yeah, it's been great, Ash.
I love being able to touch base with people overseas. So thank you guys for taking up the offer.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again.
All right, no probs. And, yeah, I'm sure we'll talk to you again sometime in the future and see what's been happening out in Illinois.
I look forward to it. Anytime you want. Anytime, man.
All right, see you.
All right, see you later.
Good day, Mike.